is now time for the Friday Roundtable. This is the show where we invite three people on to talk about a big idea or a big news item. Higher education is in the news this week, one of the many pieces to the state's budget. It's being debated and voted on at the state capitol. The House, in fact, yesterday passed its higher education budget. It includes a tuition freeze at the University of Minnesota and the Minsky system and more oversight on administrative costs. There's also funding increases for both systems and a boost in the state grant program. We've talked a lot about those numbers and proposals at the Capitol on this program. Today, I'm broadening the conversation to a very big picture question. What is the purpose of higher education? It's a question spawned by a comment made on this show a few weeks ago. We'll play that comment in a moment. But first, I want to meet our roundtable panel. Linda Hansen is with us now, the president of Hamline University in St. Paul. Good morning. Thanks
Good
for being
morning.
Here.
It's happy to be here.
Glad you're here. Tim Wines is also here. He's the president of Inverhills Community College in Invergrove Heights. Thanks for being
nice
here.
Nice to see you.
And Maureen Ramirez is policy research director at Growth and Justice. She just completed a six-year term on the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also want to let you know my colleague, NPR reporter Alex Friedrich, is live blogging this conversation. That's at the on-campus blog at nprnews.org. So here's where we're starting. Back on March 5th, we had two legislative leaders on the show, including Republican Senator David Hahn of Eden Prairie. He's the Senate Minority Leader. The discussion got on to funding for higher ed, and here's what Senator Hahn said. And he said this before, but here's what he said on the show.
The purpose of higher education is not to be job training. I want to make that clear. That is not why we do higher education. If that's why we're doing it, then we shouldn't be doing it. We do education. The purpose of education is to make sure we have a well-educated public. It's a civic duty. It's a civic responsibility. It is not job training. And I think that to make it out to be that, I think, is wrong. And I think it distorts the purpose of education.
Now, we talked about a lot of topics that day, so we didn't get to dive into this specific statement, which is what we're going to do right now. So, Linda Hansen, initial thoughts. I'm going to go around the table here. And so I'll start with you just on what Senator Hahn said, and you said this is a continuing conversation all over the country, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is. And in all of the venues where I have had seats along with my presidential colleagues across the nation, this is a very important topic to us. And my response to the senator's comment is that it need not be an either-or choice. I think that preparation for students to become good citizens and to be a well-educated contributor to the larger society is very important, but so is the importance of a career and the ability to make a lifelong living for oneself and one's family, and as a citizen to be able to give back. Education should be broad but also deep, and oftentimes we get caught up in the short-run payoff, the return on investment, if you will. And I think the broader view is how do we educate students today to be able not only to have a successful out-of-college immediate opportunity for a job, but also to have the ability to learn over an entire lifetime.
Maureen Ramirez, your thoughts?
Really, very much the same, that it's not a dichotomy. It's not going to only do one thing. Certainly, the higher education is for creating a workforce. We have doctors. We have nurses. We have people that went to school to do the job that they're doing. But we also have a responsibility while they're in school to be that they also need to come out on the other side as educated and citizens who can participate in their neighborhood. We have higher voting rates from people who go to school. And so those two things are certainly happening at the same time in higher education.
Tim Wines, a lot of this conversation about job training specifically will happen at the community college and the technical college level as well, rightly or wrongly. But there's this perception that that's where you're going to get more of what the senator was talking about in that comment.
True, but I think that the use of the pejorative, and it was used in a pejorative sense of job training, is a false straw man that's being put up. When our chancellor talks about and our board talks about workforce development, what we really mean is that, you know, putting people into jobs in Minnesota that they can not just do now, but they can do in the future, and that really does require the lifelong learner that both Maureen and Linda are talking about. You know, we want people to graduate from our schools that can do things right now in their career and their job, but also can do them 5 years down the road. I've got a phone that you've asked me to turn off that has 50 apps on it, Now, you tell me 6 years ago who you knew was an app developer, and the answer is probably nobody. But they're out there. Now there are 16-year-old kids developing apps, and I would tell my 16-year-old that the last person from England that did that made $30 million, so he needs to get going. But bottom line is that the idea that it's that all we're doing in education at our level is job training, I think it's just a little bit off, and I don't think the senator meant that. What he probably meant is that's not the sole purpose. We really do mean to do both things. We, for example, our students that are in vocational programs at, say, Dakota County Technical College and other technical schools take gen eds as well. They have to learn how to read, write, and communicate and analyze, and that's all part of the long term of being a good educated workforce.
Should, though, Tim, I guess what I'm wondering, as we look at the history of college and especially community colleges and land-grant universities, which we'll talk about in a moment, but is there a point along the way in the history where the expectation was, if I go and get a degree, I'm going to get a job? Has that always been connected to higher education, or is that a newer development than the invention of higher education?
I think it's a newer development. When I went to private schools all along the way, and I got a liberal arts degree, and all 4 years they said, learn how to read, write, and think, and you'll have a successful life afterwards. As I was graduating, the head of the provost of the college walked up and said, now go out and make a lot of money and give back to the school. it's interesting to me that I think that for a long time liberal arts colleges were, the idea was that you were preparing you for whatever was out there. And there was an excellent column in the New York Times last Sunday by Frank Bruni that discussed, Hunter Rawlings, who's head of the American Association of Universities, said, that's getting lost in the conversation of what higher ed's really about, the idea that students that graduate are explorers down the line in their careers. Mm-hmm. I think for the community colleges and technical schools, we've been pretty focused on two things. Technical education that allows a person to go into vocation and career where they can flourish long term, but it's a fairly narrow vocation, and transfer. At our school at Inver in Dakota as well, we're focused on students that are transferred to the U. In fact, we have a lot of students that transfer to Hamlin. We just gestured each other. We're on radio. Mm-hmm. That's in the NDU in Hamlin, in Augsburg, and other schools with the idea is that they're going to continue in a way that they hadn't thought about initially.
What was your degree in?
Political science. I went to law school now.
Well, you're probably getting a little bit of that degree out as a university president, as a college president.
It works.
Yeah. I'd say that's a perfect preparation for college or university.
Linda, what's
president.
Your degree in?
My undergraduate degree was a double major in English and speech communications, and I have a master's in education administration and a doctorate in educational leadership. So my pathway has been pretty straightforward, mm-hmm. in terms of wanting to – starting with as a teacher – and now when people ask me, well, what do you do? My first word is not I'm president of Hamlin University, but I'm an educator. And I think that Tim is right on in terms of this continuum of educational. In Minnesota, we're so fortunate that we really have highly integrated systems. Students today from community mm-hmm. colleges, technical colleges, all the way up through our University of Minnesota, which is a wonderful research institution, to an array of 17 private colleges and universities, and also the about 8% of students who are enrolled in for-profit institutions. There are more choices today. More opportunities for a student to find the best fit for them. And I think for us, it is really important to be able to provide a pathway that gives a student the opportunity to be creative, to be a person who forms their own pathway with the guidance of those around them, so that they actually are learning to think critically, to write analytically, to question, to challenge. And also, as we all know that a lot of people major in one particular mm-hmm. area or one discipline, and then 20 years later or 30 years later, they're running Fortune 500 companies, they're senators, they're legislators, they're running not-for-profit organizations. And so it's really our philosophy is preparation for a long-term reasonable and contributing education for life.
Well, yes. So, and the context, though, here has to be had within the cost of higher education.
Absolutely.
As well. What Tim just said is that when he went to school, he was told to learn how to learn, and then it wasn't until graduation day that he was then told, go out and get a good job. Well, that's all well and fine, because I'm sure the tuition that Tim paid way back when, which was probably only about 5 years ago, you're very young.
1983.
Yeah. Do you remember what your tuition was back then?
I do. $6,000 a year.
$6,000 a year.
I graduated with no debt.
So Tim was able to do that. Mm-hmm. He went to college to learn how to learn. Today's students, I don't know that they see that, Maureen, as a luxury, that I can go off and get that philosophy degree or that, you know, history degree if I, you know, want to do something completely different.
Well, certainly some of them do, since there are still philosophy majors and history majors. But you're right. There is, as Linda talked about, this short-term view of a return on investment that means that the minute you graduate, what's the amount of money that you're making and how does that compare to the amount of money that you had to invest in your education. And yes, you want to bring home a salary that makes you live the lifestyle that you can afford, but that's not the only thing you got out of your college education. The relationships you made, the learning that you had, the friends that are there, the value of that education compounds, and I don't think should only be measured in the dollar amount of the salary, starting salary, or are you working in your field as soon as you get out?
No, but no, you're right. But the point there, I think, is also more that one of the things you do leave college with is debt. And I also wonder if the comments we heard earlier from the senator weren't rooted not so much in what the students are or are not doing, but what the colleges are or not doing to control their costs. Wouldn't it be so nice, Linda, if we could take Tim's model and say I'm going to go off and get a degree in whatever I want because I'm interested in it and not worry about my jobs? I just don't think that's in students' minds today.
I think affordability is very much in the minds of students at our university and I'm sure across the spectrum. The facts support the tactic and the strategic measures that private institutions, where I've spent the bulk of my higher education career in, we have in the last decade basically held tuition flat. And the way we've been able to do that has been because of the tremendous amount of financial aid that we as institutions, through both private fundraising and also institutional operational funds that we've dedicated toward that, been able to push that back to the student. So that the actual net cost of attending the institution at my institution is approximately the same as what one would have to pay at a public institution. To me, that's all about access. It's about affordability. It's about choice. And so equalizing that array of choices, I think, is on all of our minds because we have to find the best fit for students. To be an integrated society, we need people who have skill sets. We need people who have advanced degrees. A lot of our graduates go on to study in the graduate schools at the University of Minnesota and across the nation. Mm-hmm. And then oftentimes we turn around and hire those graduates to come in and be our professors. So I see higher education as this huge continuum, this arc of learning, and we are very conscious of cost. And sometimes that's lost on in the debate or in the conversation nationally and regionally about how much is it affordable and what's that return on investment. And you can't measure it within the first 5 years of graduation. It has to be measured over a lifetime. And students have to weigh, is the burden of debt really worth it? And there's a lot of research that points to it, and we see it in our alumni in the pathways that they take, that it really is worth it over the long term.
Regardless of the degree, if you went off and got a degree in something that's totally not related to what you're doing now?
We find that all the time. Someone might be a major in digital art and find themselves working in higher education or working in student development. We might find someone who thought at the beginning of their college journey that they were really going to be a philosophy major, but then they end up actually running a major portion of an international global company because they were given an opportunity and because they learned how to learn, how to work in teams, how to be a part of a community, how to make an impact. We talk a lot about high impact learning wherever that degree may take them.
Tim Wines?
Well, I think that the student debt versus job conversation is the one that really is driving higher ed right now. I brought with me the Chronicle of Higher Ed from last week, and there's a headline of one of their articles is, "I fully expect to die with this debt." And it's about people that went my age, went back to grad school in their 40s, that didn't get the job they thought they were going to get, or they were underemployed, and they owe immense amount of money. One of them is a Capella student. She went and got a PhD in health administration for $90,000. She can't get a job in that area. She's a nurse. And that debt is going to be with her the rest of her life. I think for the basic undergrad level, we're really cognizant of what our students are graduating with. But then the next step is what happens to them afterwards, whether they go to the U or someplace else for their graduate school, or go to Hamlin Law School. You know, is it then worth the investment to keep moving forward? And what worries me is that the students that don't come out with a real clear career goal, they don't know what they want to do, kind of get lost in the shuffle a little bit when there's 600,000 jobs right now that are going to be open in the next few years in Minnesota. Very clear needs for students that have post-secondary ed, and they can target someplace and make a decent living and move into a career. Thomson Reuters being a great example. Mm-hmm. They want persons that have technical skills but also are lifelong learners that can read, write, and think. Mm-hmm. You get in there, then the opportunities start to open up.
You know, some of them, though, some students don't transfer, though. They go to the two-year school sometimes to learn how to make widgets because they know there's a job waiting for them in 2 years that will pay them immediately enough to make widgets.
Right. I have a lot of computer tech students that do that, cybersecurity students.
And this is what the comment was, you know, to start the show, is that that should not be the case. That you could branch that out and say if a company wants people to make widgets, they should do the training. It shouldn't be up to the higher ed system to do that training
for
them.
That's an unrealistic, I think, concept in terms of today's economy, where every single state is competing for manufacture for all kinds of businesses. And they want a lot of things. They want forgivable loans. They want to get TIF for locating a factory. They want a workforce that's there when they get there, and they want them to do what they're going to do. And so the realistically part of this economy is, you know, can we put people in those jobs? The governor of North Carolina, McCrory, made a comment last week. He says it's not – higher education is not about butts and seats. It's about butts and jobs. And only in North Carolina would they use a phrase like that. But his thought – you know, he was basically – dissing liberal arts education. I think that's going way too far, but it's also part of what's going on in terms of all these states competing for bringing jobs to their state. We have the jobs here, actually, because Minnesota's recovered faster. The point is, who can we put in those jobs? And part of the relationship between us and the business community is do we train and educate people to go in those positions but also be able to learn long-term?
Maureen Ramirez, and I'll come to you in a moment here, Linda, but Maureen Ramirez, you were talking, you know, you were a regent for the U. This is a land-grant university. Land-grant universities go back to the days of Abe Lincoln, right? Civil War. And I try to think back on this question to those days. You know, I'm trying to get a historical sense there. Would we have said during Lincoln's time that we're going to build these universities because we have a nation of farmers who are going to grow up to become farmers, and we therefore need to train them how to be farmers at the university? Or are we going to use the university to make sure we have a nation of farmers who learn how to farm on the farm, but who know history and can read Shakespeare and can comprehend physics?
Well, the second one, you know, the land grant, the Morrill Act that established the land grant universities, that was 1862. And you're absolutely right. Civil War, and Lincoln and the Congress decide that the thing that they can do, the best thing they can do, even in the war that's happening and everything else that's on their minds, is create a system of higher education. And they created it to teach agriculture, military tactics, and mechanic arts. So that was the who can be a better farmer. But they also did it to teach classical studies so that members of the working classes could obtain a liberal practical education. They did not want to create a system in the old model, which was a classics system, and that if you were wealthy and landowning and a white man, you got to go to college. They wanted to transform that radically and say, you can come here and you can get practical training and education that will be responsive to the needs of your state and your state's economy, and then that will be a self-sustaining feeding system. Mm-hmm. And you will also get a little bit of those liberal arts.
Have we lost that, Linda? Have we lost that wider view among students who go to college with the pressure of debt and the pressure of I need to find a job on the way out, therefore I need to major in whatever I'm going to do? And so if I want to, you know, make widgets or I want to be a farmer, I'm never going to study Shakespeare at college.
Well, I think clearly students are more cognizant of this as they come into college in terms of the pressure to declare a major. And some of them come in and shake my hand on matriculation day and say, I'm on a pathway to do X or Y or Z. And then you talk with that same...
And you always say, that's great.
And I say, that's great. And some of them never veer away from that. I see them at graduation and they've stayed on that path because they have a clear vision of where they're headed. Most undergraduate students, whether they're starting with me or they're starting at Tim's institution or at the University of Minnesota, they come in with an idea, and they may come in with some high school experiences that have maybe tilted them in a direction, one direction or another. But I think the focus on education for a job has to shift in terms of our thinking about what are the societal gains long term for us educating a variety of skill sets, but that can be paired with enough intellectual rigor so that you are combining both practical skills and intellectual rigor. A very good example is the way we are approaching legal education at Hamline University. Right now, nationally, law schools are under siege because there is a tremendous oversupply of seats available in law schools than there are jobs. And so if you're thinking about the affordability or the cost of a legal education today, that can often be a showstopper for many students. They begin to say, I'm not sure that over time that's really going to be worth that. But yet, as we're contemplating it, we don't think of it just as a Juris Doctorate degree, but we think about businesses that need people who have been trained in legal education. We think about students who are undergraduate students in forensic science, and perhaps they then are attracted to a legal degree, and then they go on to eventually to be a medical examiner, for example. We think of legal education as the paralegal, or somebody who just wants a master's degree in legal studies because they are so cognizant and they are in a job that relates to compliance. Healthcare, for example. Mm-hmm. Healthcare compliance and the federal regulations that are now being, you know, heaped upon the entire healthcare industry, and our industry, by the way, requires that we have people who are trained in the ability to understand, to apply, to implement the legal ramifications of their particular business. And so while a student may come into a law school, for example, with a large tab on it, the real question is, can I get a job? And in our instance, just this past spring, you know, we were ranked, we moved up 25 steps in the U.S. News and World Report ranking. And the reason was because we had the highest job placement of the four law schools in the Twin Cities area.
And there's a lot of debate about those rankings and a lot of debate about whether the Twin Cities needs four law schools. And we're not going to get that. We actually had that debate. But what you're saying there leads to this question, though. Again, going back to the cost, you're talking about putting people on paths. I often wonder, are we squeezing out with this pressurized system, especially with how much higher education costs, are we squeezing out the wandering soul, the person who goes to college not knowing what he or she wants to do?
Tom, we're full of those students. I mean, community colleges, for the most part, are made up of students that are going part-time, that come in with a little bit of baggage, and they might be sitting next to a 19-year-old kid or 18-year-old kid that just graduated from high school, but there's a lot of our students that come in going, I know I need to do something. I've put off going into higher ed for a variety of reasons, but they have the ability to do it. And at our school, I think our school is pretty typical of most of the comprehensive community colleges in the state. It doesn't matter what you're in, what major you're in, what vocation you're in. We emphasize critical thinking, communication, and civic engagement. Those are all things that go back to the Hughes land-grant philosophy, which is the well-educated citizen living in the state. We don't want them to graduate and go make widgets. I don't think anybody makes widgets.
No, that's why we use it.
Yes, that's why we use the phrase. We don't want them to go out and do that and not be able to read a newspaper and make a decision. But they are very much job-driven because they come in going, the clock's ticking. I need to figure something out, and I'm here to do that. And then if they transfer, they go on to schools like the U and Hamline. If they go into vocation, they go into that knowing they're going to have to keep on learning. But, yeah, we get a lot of folks that come in that go, you know, I'm not quite sure why I'm here. I don't know what I want to do, but mm-hmm. I know I need to be here.
But that, and Maureen, I'll go to you in a moment here, but the history has moved, the curve has moved now towards the person who says, I need a job, Right. I'm not going to go to the company and get training from the company. I'm going to go to higher ed. And that's the root of the question is why do we say we're going to go to higher ed instead of the company?
Well, don't you want a person that when they go to work for that company, you know, to kind of go back to the use philosophy way back when, that can do the things that will help them be a good citizen and also function in that job, not just pigeonholed into one thing? Because if that's all they can do, that's a really short-term proposition. And higher ed allows them to do more than just that, but also do that job.
Maureen Ramirez?
Yeah, I wanted to say that what you hear, I think both Linda and Tim talking about, are multiple points of access and multiple points of entry. So one access issue is cost, and another access issue is how do you get in and how do you start? And the robust sectors that we have in Minnesota that work in coordination with each other so that you can do a Minnesota transfer curriculum at Inverhills, take it to the U, or take it to Hamline, come back to the U, or maybe end up back at Hamline Law School. There's a whole variety of places for students to get in, and I think that's to the benefit of the state. I think it's the benefit of, you know, that 18 to 20-year-old just coming out of high school. I think it's also to the benefit of working adults and anyone else who finds themselves in a position where what they did in school is not going to serve them to get the next job that they need, and they need to come back, and that a higher education system that's responsive to the needs of working adults and non-traditional students, who in fact are actually more traditional every day, is something that is working pretty well here in Minnesota for us.
Maureen Ramirez is Policy Research Director at Growth and Justice. She just completed a six-year term on the Board of Regents at the University of Minnesota. Tim Wines is also with us, president of Inverhills Community College. He has a degree in political science from the 80s, which we learned. And Linda Hansen is president of Hamline University in St. Paul. We're having our Friday roundtable conversation. The conversation today is about the purpose of higher education. What should it be, frankly? We're going to get back to this conversation after a quick check of the hour's news with Phil Picardi. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Tom. Two Syrian officials are denying the Syrian government has used chemical weapons against rebels. Yesterday, the Obama administration said U.S. intelligence had concluded with varying degrees of confidence the Syrian government has twice used chemical weapons in its civil war. Today in the Syrian capital, a government official said President Assad's military did not and will not use chemical weapons, even if it had them. He instead accused opposition forces of using them in a March attack on a village outside of Aleppo. The 19-year-old Boston bombing suspect has been moved from a hospital to a federal medical detention center. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev left Beth Israel Hospital in Boston overnight and was taken to the medical center at the decommissioned Fort Devens Army Base about 40 miles away. Tsarnaev was shot in the throat as police tried to capture him last Thursday. The strongest consumer spending in more than 2 years is giving the economy a boost. The government says economic growth accelerated from January through March. The consumer spending offset declines in government spending and that are expected to put a drag on growth throughout the year. And country crooner George Jones has died. The Possum recorded more than 150 albums, including the hit He Stopped Loving Her Today. Jones' publicist says Jones died at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville after being hospitalized with fever and irregular blood pressure. George Jones was 81 years old. That's news on the Daily Circuit.
NPR science correspondent Elise Spiegel is our next guest for the Broadcast Journalist Series. I'm Stephen John. Join us April 29th at the University of St. Thomas. Reserve your free tickets at minnesotapublicradio.org/events.
Programming is supported by UCARE, the homegrown health plan designed to make Medicare simple. Information on the new Medicare for you or a loved one at ucare.org. UCARE, healthcare that starts with you. Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Legal Solutions from Thomson Reuters, working to help legal professionals grow, practice, and manage their businesses since 1872. You can learn more at LegalSolutions.com.
This is the Daily Circuit. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We bring three people onto the show to talk about a big idea, the big question we're talking about this week. What is the purpose of higher education? Spawned by a comment that Senator David Hand made a few weeks on the show saying that the purpose of higher education is not to be job training. This is a quote from him when he was on the show. That is not why we do higher education. If that's why we're doing it, then we shouldn't be. The purpose of education is to make sure we have a well-educated public. And we're trying to kind of split the hairs and get into the nuance of what that means and what the ramifications of that would be, and whether there's agreement there. Linda Hansen, president of Hamline University, is with us. Tim Wines, president of Inverhills Community College. And Maureen Ramirez is with us. She just completed a six-year term on the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. Linda, before the news break, you were waving your hand. You wanted to add to the conversation, so I'm going to go to you first.
Sure, thank you. I wanted to pick up on the strand of conversation we've been having about there was a time when companies did the training. You took an undergraduate student right out of college, and the companies assumed that responsibility for that training. I was recently in the company of an executive of the British Broadcasting Company, and I was very interested in the response of journalism. For example, what is our responsibility today to teach students to be prepared to be journalists? Mm-hmm. And I asked him what he perceived to be the most important component of students who are graduating and a student that he would hire at BBC. And I was very surprised with his answer, but then on reflection, I wasn't surprised, because he said, today we expect for students who are graduates of any institution, because we have worldwide stations all, you know, across the globe, who they must be linguistically capable. Mm-hmm. Second, we expect them to be creative and be able to write well and be articulate and have all the technical skills. He says, but what really makes them hireable, the ones that we would hire, is do they have intellectual curiosity? And to me, that is the purpose. That is an essence, a large part of the purpose of higher education is, do we instill that lifelong intellectual rigor and curiosity that doesn't allow a student to come out of college, maybe get a wonderful job for 5 years, and then plateau out?
You know, you bring that up, and I have a journalism degree. I'm a journalist, and I'm here to help. I say that every time I enter a room. That's not true. But listen, I would agree with what he said. I have thought back on my own degree. Mm-hmm. I have a journalism degree, but if I had to do it all over again, I would have gone back and gotten a history degree or a political science degree or an economics degree. The larger point to this conversation, though, the intellectual curiosity, though, I was so caught up on taking the classes for the journalism degree to learn the craft, mm-hmm. I, sitting here before you, never took an economics class in college. I never did it. I wish I had. Yeah. And there's something to this question of, what is the point? You know, why should I have been allowed to be more wandering soul-ish and taken the whole array of classes, everything under the sun, and then gone out and learned journalism on the job, which I could have done?
Well, you've just described the beauty of a liberal arts education, because you're able to go and have a taste and see. You're able to take that breadth in terms of being able to understand history. And you should take an economics class if you're an undergraduate of a liberal arts institution. You should have been able to amass at least a surface level, if you will, broader, and then later, a lot of students in graduate school or in their jobs choose to go specifically into a career path like journalism. But if you've not had that exposure, then those choices become more and more limited. And it's not unusual at all for students to say, well, I'm doing this today, but my undergraduate degree is in a whole other field.
So what are you going to do then? If I can be allowed to do that and become a journalist on my own terms without necessarily getting a degree, what are you going to do? And I look at you, Linda, but I'm speaking to all the presidents of colleges across mm-hmm. the country, to control the cost so that I don't come out with a huge debt that I understand long term mm-hmm. will be worth it, but right now that is jumping off the page and scaring me.
Well, certainly it is our responsibility. We have to make college affordable for our own institution and our own circumstances. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of things that we can also do to prepare them, in addition to all the things that we've been talking about, one of which is get students thinking about a career path in their third year, beginning of their fourth year, internships, career mentoring, involving alumni who are in certain fields that students may have an interest in, connecting them by way of technology with people who are already in those fields of study, helping them prepare for the real world, even as they are getting a broader sense of education as a platform, really as a starting point for a lifelong opportunities that they can pursue.
You know, Maureen Ramirez, and you were a regent for 6 years, I would suspect a lot of frustration, if there is, it has to do with the fact that, quite frankly, the U.S. made big tuition increases in recent years. So there's conversations now about today about tuition freezes and the like. And aside from the whether to raise tuition question, which I know you dealt with on the board, I think the question that's bigger that is in everyone's mind is, okay, you're going to raise tuition. Does that mean my career prospects or salary prospects, if you're going to raise tuition 14%, does that make me 14% more hireable or 14% more of a worldly person ready to take on life?
Certainly there's a role in, there's a relationship where you do want students to come out of the university and their degree has value. And the value of that degree is attached to the entire enterprise, and that entire enterprise depends on funding to make it a top three public research university in the country, as the strategic positioning plan was putting forward. And that in the marketplace that we're competing in, that means having the dollars to hire the faculty that we need, having the dollars to retain them, our putting in our biomedical discovery district and the MnDrive innovations that are in the current bill. Those things do rely on funding, and it is true that one source of funding for any of our institutions is the dollar amount that students and their families pay when they come and give us tuition. We want to be absolutely the best stewards of that and take that responsibility very seriously, as Linda's talking about, and Tim as well, that it's our job to control our costs as much as possible so that when students graduate, you know, that we haven't overcharged them and that they are getting the value with their degree that they need.
But you also understand that from the public perception, anytime you do, let's just total hypothetical, if you had to raise tuition 2% and it came to this conclusion, said we have to do 2%, there's a perception in the public that, well, you're not doing enough to control tuition because you're raising tuition. Now, your response from the U could be, well, we were really going to do it at 5, and then we found a whole bunch of ways to reduce that, and now it's up to 2. And there's a real disconnect and butting of heads between the perceptions, I guess, on the inside and the outside of what you're really doing to control those costs.
There's absolutely a misperception, and I'll tell you it's because as soon as we're in the story that says, look how much we've cut administrative costs, we've just created the story that says, look how high our administrative costs were in the first place. And I don't know what kind of narrative we can build that says, we're the University of Minnesota, we're a good value for you, and we're spending your money responsibly. At the end of the day, I think that's what Minnesotans want to know and what they want to hear, and frankly, what they deserve to hear and what should be happening over there. We have a new president. He's come in and promised to make administrative costs. He, just like the Board of Regents, just like senior administration at the university, welcomes the opportunity for some scrutiny in those costs, the reporting that we're doing to the legislature, and the ways that the university is getting its hands around their HR functions and the employees on campus. We welcome the ability to demonstrate our responsibility in those costs. Well, the university.
Right. You're using present tense. You just left
the
board.
Excuse me, yes.
No, once a region, always a region,
and,
I would say.
Well, no, I don't have to go to the meetings anymore.
Very good.
Yes.
So to back to exactly what Maureen was just talking about, which is the cost of higher ed versus the long-term gain for the student, if that's the conundrum, Minsky is the best choice because, you know, we're – if you go to any of our 7 state universities, it costs about $13,000 a year. Most of our students graduate with little to no debt. At my school, you can two-year college, you can two-year colleges. I have, you can graduate in 2 years with having cost about $10,000. And if since 71% of our students qualify for financial aid, they're going to graduate with little to no debt if they manage themselves well. Now, a lot of them have life circumstances. They do take out student loans. But it's not for education; it's to live, and they balance everything else. But we have the lowest debt, and that part of it's a nice trade-off, and it's important that a student be able to choose their course. So that's why our schools, especially in the 7 state U's that the students can transfer to, while they're also affordable, they offer a lot of the same, I think, advantages of any good private college in terms of small class size, faculty are dedicated to them. And it's a really great trade-off. That's part of the choice that you make, that in terms of what you want to do, in terms of where you want to go. The great thing about Minsky is there's a lot of choices.
So you said 13K, that 13,000, that's the average tuition, I know, across
tuition,
all.
Room and board, yeah.
Tuition and room and board across all of Minsky.
Yeah. For the state use.
For the state use.
Yeah, for us it's like we charge $5,200 a year for tuition at our place.
Linda?
I'd just like to make a comment on the back to the affordability issue and tuition increases. One of the most misunderstandings about private higher education is that people look at the sticker price without considering other factors that we consider in terms of looking at our total cost of attendance. So any of the increases that we have put into place over the last several years, even going back to a decade ago, that have primarily, if not exclusively, I know in the last couple of years, that increase has gone completely into financial aid. And what that has allowed us to do has allowed us to have more access. Hamline, for example, is north of 27% diverse students. Now, that does not match our diversity numbers in terms of the general population across Minnesota. And so keeping that cost using federal Pell Grants, the state NEED grant, which is extremely important to our students and to all of our students in any system across the state of Minnesota, it allows us to basically match the total out-of-pocket cost of someone who's going to a public institution like the University of Minnesota. So the debt, the indebtedness question, I think one has to look at value received, lifelong earnings, and the ability to manage it as a, whether you're a traditional undergraduate student or a non-traditional working adult. That's a whole population that makes up a tremendous number of our students and a number of the other institutions where they're trying to do all of it at the same time.
I've always wondered, though, on the financial aid front, the pots of money that schools set aside for financial aid does continue to grow, partially because there's more government financing for that. Why can't you just take whatever that pot is and reduce tuition by that amount and just offer no financial aid?
That has been tried. And there are many cases out there nationally, and some they've been successful and others not so successful. For us, the institutional support for a student who is financially in need and also meritorious or through need or through merit is about 45%. And that's throughout the entire part of their undergraduate experience. And for new students or coming into first students, in some instances, it's even over 50%. So we feel that the investment allows those students to retain and to stay all the way through. And they can complete on time. They're not having to go extra semesters, which adds to the cost. They get into the workforce quicker by being able to get the courses that they need in small classes, as has been mentioned. All those factors together have to be an assessment by both the student and their families. Is the value there? Is the value proposition for that particular student, and is the fit the right fit for that student?
Linda Hansen with us, president of Hamline University. Tim Wines, president of Inverhills Community College, and Maureen Ramirez, who works for Growth and Justice, but she just recently completed a term on the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. We're talking this hour on the Friday Roundtable about the purpose of higher education. The Friday Roundtable, by the way, as a daily circuit feature, is now available as its own podcast, available at nprnews.org or on iTunes. Maureen Ramirez, you noted about how the U is a very important research university. Again, as I'm a prospective student thinking about all that may be out there, why does it matter if I'm going to go get a history degree, and maybe that becomes me being a history degree, why does it matter that my debt load in some cases was increased because we need to have a world-class center on research, blah, 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 insert science here, which has nothing to do with the education that I got? Why do we need to be a research university?
Why do we need to be a research university? We need to be a research university because of our land grant mission. That's one of the three in there. And I think the value of public research is misunderstood. I think a public research university has a special and specific role to do research in the public interest. Maybe in a moment when you're a history major on campus, that public research doesn't come back and serve you when you're going to graduate or before you're going to graduate. But actually, if you wore a Gore-Tex jacket to class and wore your seatbelt when you drove there and somebody that you know and love was treated at the university hospital, you have, in fact, benefited from the public research mission of the University of Minnesota, as has everybody living here. And I think, I think the alternative to having public research universities or either federal funding for research or state money into research is corporate-driven research. And corporate-driven research is driven by profits. And that's not going to always result in the best outcomes for any of us. The things that are happening at the university are in the public's best interest. And
yeah, how well have places like the U done in telling and selling that story the way you just did? The seatbelt argument is actually a very good one. I listened to what you said and I said, oh yeah, but how well are people at the U or other land grant, other research universities selling that story?
Well, when you think of research, it can be something that's so intangible. And if you didn't know it was your seatbelt.
Well, it's intangible. And the bill, the debt that shows up on a piece of paper is not intangible. That's what I'm talking about here. I mean,
you're talking, Tom, like we're a business. And we don't declare profit and loss at the end of the year, but we do are really good stewards of the money that we receive, you know, Wenda from her donors and her students, us from the taxpayers and our students. Mm-hmm. But a lot of, if you haven't been in a – I find this all the time when I go to college fairs. People that haven't been on a college campus since they graduated, mm-hmm. they don't really remember all that stuff. And so it's hard when you get your bill to say, well, how are these two things connected?
Right.
That's a pretty long-term discussion which requires you to pay attention. And that's not always the easiest thing to do to understand the nuances of how all those things link together. Very simple story. The University of Minnesota used to have a general college, where students were admitted that couldn't get in the regular arts college. They don't have that anymore. But when they did have it, a guy named Norman Borlaug went there, who became a Nobel Prize winner. It's the only college he got admitted to. It was up here. He's an Iowa native. And had that not happened, the food processes of the world for developing countries would never have occurred the way it did. But the U saw that. And you go, how does that connect back to me? Well, you know, they got in. He did something cool. He became a researcher and brought things back to the school in the long term. It's not an easy story to sell in a world that lives by soundbites.
So where does today's Norman Borlaug go?
To community college, because we take the students that came from families that no one went to school or have very little higher ed, and they need an affordable place to go, and they're from a diverse background. And then if they're really good at what they do, they go to work and they pursue a career, or they transfer onto the U in Hamlin.
Linda?
Well, I would agree. I mean, we educated a lot of first-generation students,
yeah.
Students from minority backgrounds, students from all different strands of life. And again, I think that as a university, going back to your original question about if I were a history major, how does that relate to research, is the beauty of a university, public or private, is that the cost of delivering your history degree probably would not equal the cost of a student who majors in physics or chemistry with requirements for laboratories and with requirements for if they majored in archaeology to go out on archaeological digs, or students who are majoring in global studies to travel all around the world to have that experience. So I think it's not every single degree can be delivered at exactly the same cost.
But they are priced at the same.
They are priced at the same simply because that, again, that is sort of this incredible buffet, if you will, of a student who may be coming for a particular discipline, but along the way, they're also hopefully absorbing all of these other things we've been talking about that makes them be able to live full lives as citizens. And also, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, to change their mind, to go in a different direction. The research shows us now that people generally change their position, mm-hmm. their career path up to 7 times. That was not true 30 to 40 years ago.
Everything you just described about the universality of a university was around 20 years ago when it cost $20,000 less as well. Isn't that part of the frustration?
But the world has changed. The world has changed in terms of what does it cost to deliver something so that a student is technologically prepared. So when they walk into that workforce, that they have all of those skill sets I was just talking about earlier, and that the company or the organization doesn't have to start there from scratch. They're picking up the baton from what the student has learned in college, and then they are moving them in a direction that is most beneficial to that organization, to that company. And let's not forget public service. I mean, there is an obligation for us as educators to be certain that they are prepared, no matter where their interest, no matter where their career goals may take them.
As we conclude the Friday Roundtable, something Carrie always likes to do at the end is ask the guests what everyone's reading. So let's do a quick round the table here. Tim, what are you reading?
I'm reading Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk by Ben Fountain. He's published a wonderful book of short stories in the past that was celebrated. It's about Iraq, football, and America, and what real heroes are. And if I can make a very quick pitch, since we're talking about education, a book I would recommend very much to anybody that's interested in educational experiences in America, Absolutely American by David Lipsky. He wrote for Rolling Stone, spent 4 years at West Point, had unfettered access to their classes there, and got a really good opportunity to see what higher ed looks like on the inside.
We're going to write this down. We'll put this on the website, too, what everyone's reading. Maureen?
Yeah, I'm reading The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson.
So good.
Yeah, I'm just starting. So
I love that book. I love it. I had a chance to interview him. He won the Pulitzer. It was great. Go online, nprnews.org, listen to the interview.
I loved.
Don't get me started. I'm just going to talk for hours about how much I love that book. So I'm glad you're reading.
Right.
I approve.
Okay, I would recommend for you to read What the Best College Students Do by Ken Bain. This is our common read for all of our incoming students this year, and it talks about everything we've been talking about here this morning. Is that college students today should not just be working for the grade, for the transcript, but absolutely seeking a creative path. And it's based on research of all these very well-known people who have had incredibly successful lives because they took control of their own education and they didn't just meet the grade.
Linda, Tim, and Maureen, thanks so much for a very interesting roundtable. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to leave you with a song from George Jones. The news today, very sad. George Jones has died at the age of 81.
My money as he stared at my Corvette. He said I had one just like her son in 1963. Hell, a man down at the bank took her from me. Oh, she was hotter.